Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. I'm now here with Artemisian Aesthetic, and that this is a I don't know how you describe this, sort of art of the movement. So please, would you introduce yourself to the audience?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on, Woz. Artemisian Aesthetic is just my Instagram page name, where I do, you know, some kind of dissident-esque artwork. I also go by Jayla Dark on other platforms like Twitter, which is where I do most of my actual like political talking and shit posting, you know.
Right. And are you also on Twitter?
I am. It's under Jayla Dark.
Okay. I'll try to link to that afterwards so that people can find that easily. Okay, so we want to talk about, do you want to describe yourself, like your sort of positioning in the movement, so that people know what you know, where you're coming from, as it were?
Well, you know, I'm a woman in my late 20s. I've watched things change a whole lot in the last decade. Started really taking an interest in politics, probably more seriously about 3 or 4 years ago. But I've been paying attention for about the last 10 years, actually, and you know, just seeing, I just think that everything's changing for the worse, not for the better.
Right. Okay.
Which is why you get involved with this in the first place, obviously.
Yes, indeed. Was it the Trump thing in 2015, 2016 that made you more engaged?
Oh, definitely. Just like, you know, so many other people, the populist movement that kind of evolved around Trump really awakened something in a lot of people.
Right, and that's obviously MAGA, or do you mean the alt-right, or do you mean MAGA? What do you say that?
Both, all of it. It awakened kind of a sleeping giant of nationalism and populism.
Right, yeah, and we can talk about how that developed and how it's developed since later on. So, okay, so let's get back to 2010, so that this decade. How would you... Tell us about how the world as you saw it 10 years ago.
Well, a decade ago, I believe, yeah, it was Obama. He was wrapping up his first year in office. And I remember there was a lot of hope around that time that having our first Black president was going to help heal race relations. And it didn't take very long for to become disillusioned with that. I've seen a lot just change in my own town, really. You know, my town went from being a very American town to now it's pretty international. Right. So there's been that.
Right. Okay. That is a good way to put it. With Obama, there was a lot of, you'll probably remember the phrase, hope and change when he first appeared. And then that quickly soured, especially after the bank bailouts in 2008 and 2009 and 10, well, that was when Occupy appeared. And I think that, well, that whole thing, were you a liberal at that point, or were you always right wing?
I would say that I was more of a libertarian, right leaning. I've never been very, I guess, liberal, quote unquote, in the mainstream sense, even though, you know, those ideologies are liberal based. I never considered myself a liberal. But as time went on, I've slowly become more and more right wing. And part of it's with age, and another part of it's with information.
Right. So you weren't sort of disappointed by Obama then? I mean, you weren't part of that liberal cacophony of disappointment that happened in after the bank bailouts?
No. I mean, I honestly wasn't that surprised that he did stuff like that at all, you know, because coming from a pretty right-wing family, too, is just kind of like, oh, yep, look at that, a Democrat doing something like that. Surprise, surprise.
Do you think, was it obvious to you at that point that there was a link between the left and big business?
For me, yeah, it's always been obvious. But, you know, being a millennial, it's been that way for most of my life, and especially since I've been paying attention. It wasn't until I started getting older and getting more interested in politics and political science and stuff like that, that I started to realize that the left was originally anti-capitalist and anti-big business. It's always just kind of gone hand in hand with big business since I've been paying attention.
That's interesting, because certainly when I was younger, well, when I was young, I mean, as a teenager, an adolescent child, I assumed, I think a lot of people in Britain probably did, and maybe in America as well, assumed that the right was the side of big business, capitalism, ruthlessness, people, human beings don't matter to them, and then the left is the sensitive side, and they care about people and all that. And of course, this means that when I got older and I saw the left collaborating with big business and capitalism and corporate, the corporate world, it was confusing and didn't make sense to me. And I couldn't, like, for example, the EU, I couldn't understand what was going on. Why was this institution, which seemed very leftist, also very in league with big business? That was surprising to me. And I think the same surprise was experienced by American, young American, you know, leftist Democrats who couldn't understand why Obama bailed out the banks.
Which is, you know, kind of weird if you're someone around, I guess, my age or maybe your age too, if you aren't super informed and you don't pay that close of attention, you just kind of always saw the link between the left and the media and between big business most of your life, or at least as long as, again, you've been paying attention, like I certainly had.
Go on.
No, it's okay. I lost my thought. Go ahead.
Well, I think for me, it only became apparent once I understood the word globalist. And I don't mean any, I mean purely in the sense of it being a way of looking at the world, which is very detached from normal life, normal people, and what you might call any kind of tradition. Globalism is a very inhuman thing, which incorporates, you know, in this age, incorporates leftist social policy with right-wing capitalism, and it's sort of like the worst of both sides.
No, it definitely is the worst of both sides, because you get the bizarre kind of equality narrative and coddling from the left, along with, like you said, just ruthless capitalism at the same time. And so now, at least here in America, a lot of actually most of the more tyrannical forces like censorship and stuff like that has all been completely outsourced to the corporate world.
Oh well, this is a major thing. I mean, with America, the government is, you know, if any government, any political party wanted to introduce censorship, they would be hamstrung by the First Amendment. So it's great for them that the corporations are willing to do it for them. And that circumvents accusations, not only of violating the First Amendment, but even accusations of being censorious, because they can say, no, we're not censoring. We're just cleaning up our platform. A right to free speech is not a right to speak anywhere. And this is a private business. So this is a big deal. And we talk about it all the time. They get around these ethical issues just by saying, well, this is our platform, this is ours, so you don't have a right to free speech anywhere. And, you know, that's true, except for the fact that these are the places where everyone exercises their freedom of speech nowadays, so, or where everyone engages in discourse nowadays. So really, they should be included as under the First Amendment and as public spaces, because they are increasingly the most pertinent, the most relevant public spaces. But so that happens in America, but outside of America, in Britain, for example, the government has also done the same thing, basically. It's saying, well, we're not going to increase the hate speech legislation because it's already causing us enough bad press and enough of a headache. So instead, we'll just encourage the same thing as in America. We'll encourage the social media platforms to do the censoring for us. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Right. And it's kind of like this game of tactical libertarianism so that they can justify these private platforms doing this, which they're, how private are they really when they're near monopolies, first of all? And second of all, you know, people, like you were saying, these are the public squares now. People don't go out into an actual town square anymore to have these discussions. We are doing it all online. And there's no real incentive, especially not for the mainstream left to do anything about it, but not for the mainstream right either, because the mainstream right likes to keep the right, you know, on their path, on, you know, their kosher path. You have to stay within these bounds. These are the acceptable bounds of right-wing thinking. So they don't want people to hear what we have to say, because they are ultimately liberals themselves.
See, that's the more interesting side of this. I've just heard that Eric Stryker has been banned from Twitter just a couple of hours ago. That's a real shame. Sorry to hear that. It's in the live chat just now. The more interesting, of course, we understand why the left censor and why they want censors, because they culturally, they own this the current paradigm. It's theirs. So, of course, they want to protect it from anything that could threaten it. But the more surprising, I mean, that just makes perfect sense. The more surprising thing is that the mainstream right is in on this because they don't really have much interest in the cultural or moral or social sphere. They're happy to sort of leave that to the left and to just follow the left's lead on it, on anything in that regard. I mean, you know, in Britain, we had a conservative government that introduced gay marriage. It wasn't a left-wing liberal government. It was the so-called conservatives who did that. So they're happy to do that because what they're primarily concerned with, I'm guessing, this might be a bit naive, but what the right are primarily concerned with is economics.
Well, economics and their donors. You've got to remember who their donors are and what their donors want. And their donors are social liberals. Like, they want to expand the liberalization of the social sphere where everything is acceptable and there are no real traditional moral standards anymore. So the right caters to those people. They cater to the ones who want big business to stay big and get bigger and who also want to keep pushing the social thing. So what you get from the mainstream right is pandering to the social issues that we care about without actually ever doing anything about them. But then we get the awful economics.
Yeah. And of course we get the awful social policies. I mean, I think the one that everyone can agree on is the trans thing. And I don't want to go too much into this for obvious reasons, but I do think that that's a watershed. I think most people feel this is beyond the pale. It's too much. And I mean, I just I think yesterday or the day before, J.K. Rowling, who's a famous, you know, agonizing liberal progressive woman, has got into trouble for not being pro-trans enough. So, you know,
I saw that.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's an issue where you're supposed to go beyond what you're comfortable with, what everyone is supposed to go beyond comfort and just accept this. Like, men and women, it doesn't really exist and it's an illusion. And, but this throws everything into chaos.
Oh, no, it completely does. And we're not allowed to question it either, even though there are... there's definitely research out there to suggest that a lot of them are not these poor people who really do just believe that they're a woman in a man's body, that a lot of them are, you know, actually predatory. There's research to back that up. And it's stuff that actually does impact our everyday lives outside of just doxing. I can't use my gym's locker room because there's one of them that goes to my gym.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect anecdotal example of something, a massive social trend, a cultural thing impacting someone in their own personal life. But it does reach everyone in the end. You know, that's the thing. I think something that seems to be happening now is that liberal parents are realizing that, oh, the social trends that I've been encouraging in my teens and 20s are now going to affect my children at their school. And I think that's it's a bit of a wake-up call for a lot of liberals. You know, when it actually affects their own, well, it's their own child being told that he might be a girl or vice versa.
Yeah, and I think we are seeing an increase of people coming from the left more towards our side because of the social madness and the absolute chaos. Because what these people genuinely believed in tolerance and love and stuff like that, I think, at least on an emotional level, that's why they went with it. But now they're starting to see the real world effects and see it enter their children's classrooms. It's a completely different story because, as we know, it's like, it's one thing to be tolerant of people who are different and another thing to try to change people into being like them.
Oh yeah, indeed. So to get back to 10 years ago then, I think we got onto this because I was talking about Occupy and all that, and the initial disillusionment with Obama, and that that then led to the libertarian thing with Ron Paul. So, you know, do you want to take it from there? Because I imagine you've got something to say about that, being a recovering libertarian.
I assure you I'm fully recovered. But yeah, Ron Paul, he was the last person to really invoke the populist feeling in Americans. And then, of course, the one before that was Pat Buchanan. So this has actually been something that's been building up for a long time. And it was Trump who was the first one to actually make it work and get into the presidency. Ron Paul is just a good-natured man, and he truly believes in the old-school ideals of American liberty, you know, and that mythos. But unfortunately, as we can see, that's just been completely perverted at this point.
Well, yes. And do you think that that was... do you think that that was not realized by his supporters at that time? Do you think it... like, another few years later, a lot of them were supporting Trump, and... Well, what would you say are the differences between those two phenomena, the Ron Paul craze and then Trump mania in 2015?
Well, Ron Paul was obviously a lot more presentable and articulate, I guess, than Trump was. Trump speaks the people's language a lot better. You know, he's a lot more crass. Just to be completely honest, you know, you're around working class people. They're not super classy like we see all these politicians. And Trump really spoke to that side of working class people. He spoke like one of them. And I think that's what really attracted people to him, is that he spoke their language.
And I can believe that, although he does seem to have come from a wealthy background himself, which is, you know, this is something that's held against him by the left. They'll say that he's faking that working class touch.
Well, yeah, probably to an extent. I mean, he is a massive business mogul. He knows how to advertise. He knows his audience. He knew exactly whose votes he was trying to get.
Yes. So what else would you say about that transformation that occurred between supporting Ron Paul and supporting Trump?
You know, I'm not really sure if there's that much more to say about it. I guess people really started dropping more of the, you know, total free market ideas, or at least after Trump was elected, that started happening a lot. I think a lot of people just got completely disillusioned with the idea of what America is and was always supposed to be. And so they decided to go with Trump because it was more realistic, or at least so it seemed.
So what's the difference then? I mean, like, what did these people believe America was and was supposed to be in 2012 compared with like now?
Well, back then it was still very much centered around the liberty and justice for all kind of ideas, and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and everything like that. But I think as more time goes on and we see more and more abuses against that, the less people really believe in it.
Why not?
Well, because it's not stopping anybody from abusing people at this point. You know, the Constitution, they don't follow it. I mean, how many laws do we have that are just completely unconstitutional, but it doesn't matter.
So you think that people are, people are seeing that the American dream was never really real. Would that be correct?
I think some people would see it that way, and other people just see it as dead or dying.
Right. Okay. Well, when would you say was the last time that the American dream was real?
God, probably not since the 50s or 60s, honestly.
And is that, I mean, tell me more, elaborate on this. Don't be afraid to elaborate. I'm interested in your perspective on this. Why? What has changed since the 50s? I mean, obviously demographics have changed. Are there any other things?
Morality has completely changed. Family formation has completely changed. The ability to afford things has completely changed. I mean, being able to afford property now is extremely difficult for young people. The price of property has just skyrocketed, and that has a lot to do with the push towards urbanization and population growth. So the demand for property as well. And then also because the banks pretty much own everything. You can't ever really own your property. You have to go through a bank first to buy it. And then you have a mortgage for what, like 30 years. And then after that, on top of that, and after that, you still continue to pay property taxes. And all of this stuff just goes up with the population.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that's a consistent thing that Americans say about modern America, and why they voted for Trump. It seems to be that they lost faith in the idea that any like an ordinary guy, the everyman, which was a very, very popular American archetype, was the notion that anyone could rise to the top, anyone could do well. I think they lost faith in that idea. I think America seems to have become a much more stultified nation where people cannot do that anymore. I mean, there are the famous memes of the boomer. I've forgotten what his name is, but the famous one where it's a young guy in the 70s and giving advice to a young millennial today or a young Gen Z today. And he's just completely naive because he doesn't understand the world has transformed and you cannot afford a new house just straight out of college like you could in the 70s.
Right. No, you really can't. And I mean, today, like if you're in a right to work state, if you get out of college, you're immediately, you know, you have the culture trying to funnel you into an unpaid internship. So that means that you've also got to work, continue to work your crappy job that got you through college, as well as work this unpaid internship for free. And then hopefully you make the connections that you need. And then after you're done with that, then you've got to compete with God knows how many people for this small pool of jobs. And these corporations that you're competing to get a job with are also importing all kinds of people to stagnate the wages. So it's just gotten ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, it just seems like, see, this is a perfect manifestation of globalism. And it really does simply work against ordinary people. I think that's become very, very obvious in the last 10 years. What do you say about that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just on the economic front either, but also on the cultural front, because when you have all, you know, the entire world packed together, living around each other, there's no community. That's where I think liberalism really thrives, because it's hard to actually get people together to combat something in your community because people aren't connected to each other at all anymore. And so it becomes kind of an anything goes situation because you have to be sensitive to each other's cultures.
Well, that's an exhausting thing. And, you know, you see that here as well in Britain, you see it all over Europe. The pressure that multiculturalism creates, the complexity of life that it creates. Things that would have been straightforward are suddenly not just complicated, but a minefield where you can put a foot wrong at any time without meaning to. And of course, you know, white people are very given to self-examination and guilt. So they obsess over this.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it's like walking on eggshells all the time. Like you have to worry about what you say with people because you don't know if it's going to offend them. And this is especially bad around like the LGBT community. You know, you have to be very careful with what you say because you might offend them. And it's just, it makes everything extremely awkward. It makes it difficult to navigate. And then especially in the workplace too, which is why now we have all these different rules from HR that come through for every workplace that, you know, creates a very, very rigid and uncomfortable atmosphere just to work in because you have to abide by these PC rules. And heaven forbid you could go against one of those. You could get fired.
Well, again, look at what's just happened to J.K. Rowling. I mean, she thought that she was up to speed with the current rules and has discovered that she's not. I don't know what the effect of that will be on her career or on her credibility.
I don't think it really matters because no matter how many Twitter crucifixions she goes through, she's still filthy rich.
Yeah, well, she's still rich, but I think at this point, for her, it's not about the money anymore. I think she's addicted to virtue signaling.
Oh, probably. I mean, there's a lot of people that you see who are like that. They're all in it for the likes and retweets.
Well, yeah. And because, of course, if you've got as much money as her, you don't need any more. I mean, I'm sure she wouldn't say no to any more money. But I think for them, for that stratum of society, it's really just how good a person can I be? And how many people can I show how good a person I am? So I think it really matters to them at this shallow level, but still very pertinent for them. And it really matters to them to be up to speed. And I think it's almost like a shock for them when something like this happens, where she realizes, I've said something intolerant. I've said something reactionary. And all she said to fill this in for anyone who doesn't know was that she backed up someone who was saying that men can't become women or vice versa. Women can't become men. So she wasn't sufficiently up for the trans thing. Because she was, I mean, just by saying that, she was implicitly admitting or stating that men and women exist, that there is a gender binary.
Right. Well, she's just another, I mean, I won't say victim, but she's just another person who's falling into the luxury belief system, which is what you see from a lot of these rich woke types, is that it's a luxury belief. Not only are they obsessed with the idea of coming off as a good person, but it's also a status signal to believe in these things. They are signaling to you that they are a person of high status, and they're not like those low class people who are racist and xenophobic and homophobic and transphobic.
Oh, absolutely. And someone did say this to me a few days ago. There is a class war element to what we're seeing here, where anyone, well, there's a divide, because people who consider themselves educated have a certain set of beliefs, and then anyone who doesn't is who doesn't hold those beliefs is considered uneducated and stupid.
No, exactly. For you to believe these things shows that you've gone through the initiation into being a member of higher society, I suppose. And it's really not a surprise that corporations have gone full woke, because remember, the millennial generation was the one who went to college during the hardest push for all these weird things. So now that the millennial generation is in the corporate world and climbing the ladder, they are abiding by that ideology that they absorbed in college, and they are still associating that ideology with status and with reputation and with power.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is a trick that's played, as you're told at 16, this set of beliefs A is what clever people believe, and you're clever, so obviously you have these beliefs, right? Because if you don't, then, well, you're not as clever as I thought you were. So that appeals to people's vanity. And they think, okay, well, I want to be a clever person. So, okay, I'll believe those things and I'll espouse those things. And then they do. And I think this is a massive part of how, it's like a confidence trick, really. It's a massive part of how these ideas are transmitted. It's simply by conning people. It's like selling the product, and you say this is what this product will say about you, so you want to own this product because you want this message about you to be transmitted to everyone else. I think that's a massive part of this. But as for the millennials, yes, they are now into, they're no longer the 22-year-old SJW. They are now in their 30s, or even in their mid late 30s, and they're starting to have authority in these corporations, which is very worrying indeed, because as you say, they imbibed probably the worst of this and with the least resistance. I think Generation Z, Gen Z will have more resistance to it. I think the millennials were really just lambs to the slaughter.
Oh yeah, because I mean, at least for me, this access to information with the internet and communication, social media didn't really take off until I was in high school. And so a lot of people and dissident ideas certainly way after that, which social media and the internet completely changed everything. Just this access of information. It's very similar to the way the printing press changed Europe way back in the day and rocked those power structures. So a lot of us, it was very new. It was all very goofy. It was all about sharing pictures and saying goofy things with your friends. And slowly, as people went to college, it started turning into, you know, their liberal ideological circle jerks and asserting themselves. And now people are attaching their own egos to their social media profiles and stuff like that. And so a lot of them are really not capable, I think, of being able to handle disagreement, because they take it as an attack on their ego. But what's so funny about these, I guess, shitlib types is that if you've ever actually argued with them, they can't argue. Like, they can't actually back up their beliefs, because their beliefs aren't really rooted in any facts. All they have are these abstract conceptions of the way things are. It's all very abstract and subjective. So when you actually hit them with facts and with your actual priorities and what you actually think and with history, they don't know how to handle it. They get quote unquote triggered.
I think, yes, indeed. I'm not going to dispute that for a second, because I've experienced it myself many times. But I think it's important to note that probably most people have always been like this. Most people go along to get along. They conform to the mores of their society. And so it just happens. I mean, and so if you'd asked them 100 years ago, why do you believe this? Most people probably wouldn't have been able to give you a fantastically cogent and intelligent answer as to why they believed X, Y, or Z. But the unfortunate thing is, it's now, well, first of all, the beliefs that are fashionable are insane. But also the people who espouse them most vigorously are fairly intelligent, but they're not as intelligent as they think they are. You know, a lot of them have been conned because they were told to go to university, and then so they went and they got a degree, which they think means that they're clever. And so trying to get through to them is very difficult, especially when, as you say, there's also this, they identify themselves with the beliefs that they espouse. So if you disagree with their beliefs, it's seen as a personal attack on them and a sort of psychological assault, when it really doesn't need to be. The other part of it is, of course, that because they've not had to defend these beliefs, because they've just been poured into them at college, they've never had to defend them, so they can't. And so the way they react is by getting defensive and sort of paranoid and just shutting down. I mean, it's very sad. Sometimes, Janet Taylor said this on his Millennial a couple of nights ago, that it's almost like a cult. It's almost like brainwashing. Their response is to panic and to hate you. And it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant when you try to politely, gently disagree with someone and they respond by calling you evil. That's not a nice experience.
No, it's not. And I think a lot of people in our circles are pretty used to that at this point, so it doesn't really faze us that much. But the thing about, I guess, the progressive shitlib belief system is that it's very religious. And that's why I think they get so defensive. It's the same way as when you attack a lot of people's religions, except for a lot of Christians now, because we're also so very used to it. And so they do get very defensive because, like you said, they don't necessarily know why they believe what they believe, other than the fact that they've always been told that they should believe that. And it's something that appeals to their ego because, oh, I'm so clever for thinking this. But I can't help but wonder how much, I guess, hyper-reality has to do with that, the internet sphere itself, because people assume, oh, I must be incredibly clever and smart and such a good person because I've got 300,000 followers on Twitter and I get 500 likes per tweet. And so they really do associate these ideas with their own egos. And as for what they're surrounded by, you have to wonder how much do they even talk to the people that they're surrounded by about these ideas genuinely? Because if they did in private, they'd come to find that quite a few people disagree with them, at least in their families, people who are comfortable with saying as much to them in their private lives. But of course, in their work settings, they're not going to be used to that because everyone has to tiptoe around and, I guess, carry the banner of it to keep their jobs. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that most people, I don't think, actually agree with this. They're just the ones who are in power and who believe that they're right because it's a religiosity. They associate it to not just their egos, but also morality. It's almost like a worship of both the self and the other. It's very bizarre.
Oh, it is. And a certain thing that it breeds is a lack of self-reflection, lack of self-awareness, self-examination. I think that's a huge part of this. Because, I mean, any genuinely thoughtful person does at some point think, why do I believe this thing? What are my reasons? What are my motivations here? And I think a big part of liberalism, or as we know it today, progressivism, is to bypass that circuit. It sort of says, don't worry about why you believe. You believe this because you're a good person. That's it. That's all you need to know about this. And so, but of course, everyone knows deep down that there's a worry. I'm not a good person, and I don't believe this. There's a chance that I'm actually a bad person, or there's a chance that I'm actually an idiot, or there's a chance that I've never really thought this through at all. There's a chance that this other person knows something I don't. But because they haven't been trained in how to handle this self-doubt, their only reaction is panic and of course hatred. And of course they're also preloaded with that. That is installed in them at college. Hate people who disagree with you because they are racist, bigoted, small-minded, angry, insecure, hateful, etc. So they've got all these reasons not to take seriously anyone who disagrees with them, and even to actively despise anyone who disagrees with them.
And what's so strange about that is that, again, this is just showing more in the projection that they have when it comes to this, because, you know, I'm not motivated by hatred for anyone. I'm motivated by love for my own. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't seem to realize that those of us who come to more dissident opinions, we kind of come to them kicking and screaming. You know, we didn't necessarily want to believe these things. We didn't want to think the way that we do. We just ended up doing that, which is, ironically enough, the result of being more open-minded and being curious, as opposed to them who are not, they're not open-minded or curious at all. They're not tolerant at all. It's quite the opposite. Again, it's just projection.
Yes. I think that it's very important to say, I've said this myself, and I think it's important to, it bears repeating. A lot of the opinions that are held in the dissident right are not happy opinions about the world, about the way people are, human nature. It's not something that most people want to believe, right? It's not, I think the progressive view is basically that everything is possible, people are endlessly flexible and inherently good, and culture gets in the way of that and stymies it and makes them bad, and that's all. Most people are intelligent and capable and compassionate and creative and just amazing. And this really is an insanely unrealistic view of human nature. I mean, this is why I think the concept of original sin is so useful. I've said this before. I said this back in 2014. Even if you're not Christian, even if you're not religious, the concept of original sin is so useful because it awakens you to the concept that man is a fallen creature. And I think it's much more important to have that fallen view of man than to have the opposite view, that people are innately good. And it's interesting that a lot of people come to the dissident right via libertarianism, because I think that libertarianism is sort of the last attempt to maintain that belief in that people are innately good and capable. I think libertarianism still has that delusion embedded in it that people could handle life without the government and without the state. And the truth is, the vast majority of people couldn't. And the vast majority of libertarians couldn't. But I think that it's interesting that I do see it that way. I see libertarianism as a last gasp of trying to believe in a utopia and a utopian. It's the last gasp of trying to maintain a utopian view of the human condition.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it that way. In my opinion, the way that I viewed libertarianism was kind of as a white expression of leave me alone, an acceptable white expression of that. And it's also the mainstream approved third position that you're allowed to take. So I think people who are drawn to a different option, especially in a two-party system, end up going that way first. And I guess these people would be more open-minded and I guess technically more free thinking, and would eventually, that would explain why so many of them ended up here.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's all or nothing. I'm not saying that libertarians are just stupid, but they although they often say stupid, like unbelievably stupid things, but I think I think you're right that it is that third option that more thoughtful people go to, and then they realize its limitations, and so they end up with views more typical in the dissident right. I mean, lots of people are agreeing with me about libertarianism, and I don't like to pour scorn on libertarians because a lot of them are well-meaning. But, you know, I mean, just yesterday I saw on Twitter, hold on a minute, I'll find you the exact statement. Just because we're on this topic, and I'm not going to dwell on it for long.
Libertarian Party.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I kind of went off a little bit on them for that too.
Yeah. This is the tweet from the Libertarian Party. What do you say to white Americans who are uncomfortable with the idea of becoming a racial minority? There's only one answer. You don't get to use the government to determine the racial makeup of the nation, and so you can't use the government to maintain the country that you've always known. I mean, if you can't use the government to do that, then I really don't know what's going on. But anyway, he then elaborated and said something like, if you ever wanted to use the government to do this, then you were never a libertarian. So there you go. I mean, and then of course the replies to this are just—it's just a cascade of moronic remarks.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I saw a lot of hopeful remarks in there myself, not just from, I guess, our guys, but also people who I guess are starting to lean a little bit more towards our, who are like, never mind, I'm not a libertarian anymore.
I think I got to it when it was just the libertarian people. And so it was just these people echoing that notion and saying, yes, I would never want to use the government to do anything at all. I mean, really, I would. What they're saying in effect is, I would rather everything fell into disrepair and disaster and chaos rather than use the government to prevent that happening. I mean, it's just
rather than use the government to do its one real job.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just so naive, you can't believe it. And I do see it as rather childlike. And, you know, I went through the phase as well, right? I've got to, you know, come clean about this. I was a libertarian for about a year, around 2007, 2006, 2007. I think by 2008, I was starting to grow out of it. And yes, amazing nowadays to see people being libertarians. So, okay, let's get back to the timeline. I mean, this is a very interesting conversation, and I want to get back to the chronology of it. So from Ron Paul to Donald Trump, so Trump mania, 2015, 2016, give me your thoughts on that.
Well, it didn't really start off as Trump mania. Trump actually kind of started off as a bit of a joke. I mean, I even thought that he was a bit of a joke, and so did other people. It's like, oh, this reality TV star billionaire is running for office, ha ha. And then he started saying things that really appealed to people's interests, common people's interests, like build the wall and deport them all, which were the main things that interested just about everyone who voted for him. We can see how that's gone so far. But so I think that's what really like awakened people, is that he was appealing directly to these unspoken interests that we had that nobody else would.
And what were those unspoken interests?
Well, it's primarily demographic. You know, I mean, us regular people, we're seeing our neighborhoods change for the worse. We're seeing our towns become internationalized. We feel like strangers in our own country.
Yeah. I mean, the demographic one is obvious to you and me and to most people watching this probably. But how much do you think that Trump was ever really sincere about that?
It's hard to say. I really don't know, because on one hand, it seemed very sincere, or at least the movement around him was incredibly sincere if he wasn't. And on the other, we have to remember who he is and what he's good at, which is business and advertising. So I'm really not sure. I try not to think about it that way, because it doesn't really matter ultimately.
Yeah. So what other things, you said the concerns that no other people would talk about, what other concerns apart from demographics?
Well, also economic concerns. You know, he talked a lot about bringing manufacturing back and bringing a lot of jobs back. And that's kind of happened a little bit, but most of the jobs are, you know, part-time and the wages are still stagnant and there's still more immigrants coming in, keeping them stagnant. And as for manufacturing, a lot of it's foreign-owned. So, you know, you're working for foreigners under, you know, bizarre, I guess, expectations or stricter expectations. There's no real labor movement anymore, so there's no real hope of changing that.
Yeah, it does seem like America has become such a massive society, such a just huge in its scale and its density, that it would be difficult to come up with, to create any movement that got any traction. It seems like something, basically the whole thing has to, if not collapse, then it has to suffer a lot at this point in order for any sort of real change to happen. What would you say about that?
Oh, absolutely. It has to. I mean, first and foremost, Americans are fat. So let's not expect like actual direct action anytime soon. And also, it's just that American identity is so incredibly fragmented now. You know, we've been fed our entire lives, you know, this land is your land, this land is my land, and everyone's equal, and just let them all in, and it's fine. And so it's like, because American identity can be anything now, it's really nothing.
Oh, well, it's the same everywhere. You know, anyone can be British, anyone can be German, anyone can be... In fact, I heard in Sweden there was a guy contacted me. I think he was 17 at the time. He was very he was depressed at school, and he wanted to tell me about this. This is like, I don't know, 4 years ago, and he said to me that he was told in class in Sweden that Swedish culture is that there is no culture. Every individual has his own culture. And I've heard the same from Canadians as well. I think Trudeau prided himself on it. He said something like, Canada has no culture. The Canadian culture is multiculturalism, and there is nothing core to it. There's nothing. No other way to put it. And you know, that is a pretty idea. I don't even think it's a nice idea, but it's pretty. It's ornate, but it's not realistic. It's not workable, and it's completely suicidal.
Well, not just that, but it's a lie too, especially for a place like Sweden that has existed for so long. It has been stable as a culture and a people for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years at this point. How tragic is that they believe that they don't have a culture now that they're being taught that? In America, it's almost passable because we have had such a hodgepodge of different Europeans coming here up until the 1965 Immigration Act, where they started bringing in the rest of the world too. So I think it's a little bit more believable for a lot of Americans growing up because, you know, the white kids, when you're in school, what we talk about is our heritages and, you know, oh, I'm Irish. Oh, I'm German. Oh, I'm French and I'm English and this and that. So we were kind of used to that of all, like, even as just white people just coming from completely different ethnic backgrounds, technically.
Sorry. Wait. Yes. But of course, now it takes on this other, I mean, that is an interesting question, right? About white America. Do you think it? I don't want to give my own thoughts on this because they're not, perhaps not very informed. Do you think there ever was a solid white American identity, and is there one still now?
Was there? Absolutely, and I think that was especially prevalent after World War II. Funny enough, which. You know, whatever you think about World War II, the fact of the matter is, as far as its ramifications for America, is it was incredibly uniting for the people. People went from being German and Italian and Irish to being white American. And it wasn't until later deconstruction and subversion of academia that started breaking down again.
Yeah, it's unfortunate how this happened simultaneously. On the one hand, those regional heritages were merged into one and sort of... diluted and lost, but at the same time, the American collective identity was deconstructed. So it's very confusing. I mean, on the one hand, they're all merging into one, but at the same time, the idea of merging into one and there being a white America was being attacked.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, on the bright side, I think that this attack is kind of reforging that white American identity. Ironically enough, I guess E. Michael Jones would say that's a negative identity, but not really. I don't think so. I think it's just making us more aware of the genuine identity.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me when I see photos of America from the 80s and the 90s, and even today, but especially the 80s and 90s, it does look like something. You know, it's not a nothing. It is like white Americans, God knows what their heritage was. Maybe they're part Swedish, part German, part English. Doesn't matter. It does seem like there was something. I mean, you can't say that those people are just engaging in these photos from yesteryear, are just busily engaging in nothing. That's not really possible. It's not really physically possible. They have to be involved in something. And so... There must have been something. What would you say about this?
No, absolutely. I mean, and it still does exist. We're just not allowed to really say as much. And as far as like an actual white American ethnicity goes, it definitely does exist. And it's kind of defined by a mixture of Western European and a little bit of Eastern European as well heritages. You know, if you meet a white American, the chances are they've got at least three or four different European ethnicities, you know, because there's been different waves throughout different periods of time and people have intermarried to create it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Someone saying no one is pure woes. I know that. I'm talking about the culture, because it's referring to what I said earlier, that these different German Americans, Irish Americans merged into one after World War II. Yeah, I know that they were never pure. I don't care about that. I'm speaking in generalities, that those heritages, you would have had a bloodline that was Irish American for three or four generations, and then it would merge into the German. So yes, it does seem to me that it was something real. Definitely in the second half of the 20th century, it just seems like, and again, it's possible to be very nostalgic and rose-tinted about this, especially because it was an America that I never saw. I didn't see America until I saw it in 1996 as a kid, really. And then I saw it just briefly for like 10 days. And then I saw it in 2016. It's not my country, but you know, looking at it from outside, yeah, it does seem like there was something there. And so this is why it's kind of ridiculous for this notion that now that there is no such thing as America. I mean, I hate it when I hear Americans, like liberal Americans, saying, well, what do you mean by America? What do you mean by white America? And yeah, I mean, come on. I, of course there was something there.
Right. And what's funny is that like even white American identity does kind of vary from region as well. Like you've got the Southerners where it's, you know, there's a lot of hunting, there's a lot of guns, you've got country music. And I mean, it's kind of like just very, very revolves around like genuine freedom. You know, you've got these dark country back roads and people talk about, you know, drinking and driving because there's no one on the road and stuff like that, and being able to just go into your backyard and hunt a deer if you want to. And then you've got Northeastern culture, and then you've got California culture, and you've got Midwestern culture, and you've got Great Plains culture. So even that varies based on region, like the culture itself.
But would you say that that is I don't want to use the word diluting again, but would you say that the regional cultures of America are becoming more, you know, homogenized together into a general America? Or do you think that those, you know, there is still a difference?
Oh, it's definitely becoming more homogenized. And I think that has a lot more to do with the internet and with communication than with anything else.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Britain, the regional accents, which used to be very sharp and distinct, are merging all the time. They're getting less and less distinct from each other. And there's a general average emerging. And it's because, I mean, it's not because of immigration, because it's got nothing to do with that. It's because of mass media. It's because of TV, really. And also there's an American influence on it as well. I see with the Gen Z, because they consume so much American media. So you can hear that twang in the accent of the young. So that is a thing. And again, I don't know what implications that has for the future. But clearly, you know, liberals tend to accuse us of wanting to preserve something in aspic. I really don't think that's the case. But it isn't. It's impossible to know how this is going to go. But if you were to speak about the future, we've been going for about 50 minutes now. So what would you? I mean, let's talk about the Trump presidency and what you predict for the future. So 2015 to, and then he got in 2017, and then the 2 years since then. How do you think things have developed?
Oh, well, he's been almost useless. You know, I mean, he hasn't protected any of the people who actually voted for him. He's got a worse deportation record than Obama. All he's done is repair some of the wall that already existed. In my opinion, Trump keeps a lot of people on the right complacent, or at least the normie right, the people who aren't as paying as close of attention.
The MAGA peeps.
Yeah, I think that he keeps them complacent. And if we had a Democrat in office, I think that there'd be a lot more backlash against these things. At the very least, things wouldn't be changing. But Trump is just, in my opinion, he's just letting Democrat policies slide through quietly.
Yeah, when he launched his campaign for this new election coming up, and he said that his the campaign slogan was "Keep America Great." I thought, you know, you've got to be joking. I mean, are you saying that in the space of 2 years you've made America great, and now this current situation is great? This is a situation of greatness that Americans are now experiencing. This is the goal, and now we've got to keep this, or Americans have got to keep this. We've got to maintain this. I mean, that is so hollow and just stupid.
No, it is. It's very hollow and stupid because I've seen nothing really improve. I mean, like we were saying, in the last 10 years, you were talking about this idea of America that is something, you know, that you witnessed. You know, sadly enough, I only got to see that for a few years in my life because I spent my childhood in Southern California before my parents packed up and moved us to the American South, where it was genuinely very American for a short period of time, I guess. And then as I started getting older at this point, you know, this town that was a really nice all-American town has just become completely international. I mean, our new small business owning class is just all Indians and our new labor class is just all Hispanics. So I'm not sure what greatness he's talking about. I still feel like an alien in my own country.
It's very sad because there was so much hope for attached to the whole Trump thing, Trump mania. And I mean, I remember it. I saw it. I was there, and just for like a month, and I did. You know, I experienced it, and the excitement that people felt, also the disappointment because I was in that liberals felt because I was in Portland when the election happened, and you know, there was a pall of misery that descended over the city over all the hipsters on the night of the election, but. And then the next day, I interviewed people in, I forgot what it was called now, but a square in the city. And they were just lost for words. They didn't know what had happened. How could this have happened? But anyway, the point is that they really needn't have worried, those liberals, because he hasn't really done much.
No, and if anything, he's helped them out in a lot of ways. I mean, we just look at this big spending bill he just signed in. It's pretty much everything the Democrats wanted and the neocons wanted. You know, they just gave amnesty to over 4,000 Liberians, which is hilarious considering that the founding of Liberia is former slaves from America who wanted to go back to Africa. And I guess now they want to come back here. You know, they have a near identical constitution to ours. So, you know, this would be a good question to start asking some of these mainstream normie conservatives. It's like, why do you think Liberia is the way it is when it's set up almost exactly like we are?
Yes, exactly. Of course, that's always a very good example to use. But let's not get into that here.
No.
That's not safe anymore. You know, in 2015, 16, even 17, we could talk about that at leisure, but not anymore. So, okay, what are your predictions for the future of America?
Well, I think Trump is probably going to continue with his betrayals especially in his second term when he doesn't have to worry about re-election. He just has to, I guess, keep his head. And God knows what they've got on him, why he continues to do this. I don't know. It doesn't really matter because he's just going to do what they want. But I think that I think he's definitely going to win 2020 just because of how insane the Democrats are, even though I'm going to be sitting this one out. But I think that a Democrat's going to win. And I think we're just going to keep going through these cycles for a while. And I think that demographics are going to continue to overwhelm. But I think that the spirit of that white populism is going to stay alive. And I think it's actually going to get bigger because, you know, the longer they ignore the material conditions and legitimate grievances that we have as a people, the worse it's going to get. And the more people are going to start acting out and speaking out. And especially as our standard of living decreases, which it is, you know, all these plastic shiny products that they put in front of us isn't a good standard of living. You know, the more people can't have families and afford property, the worse it's going to get, especially when food prices continue to go up because of growing population. I think that's going to grow the spirit itself. But as far as Trump is concerned, I don't really have any hope.
Oh, yeah. I'm I'm sad to hear that, but I'm not surprised, and I can't tell you that I disagree. So, it does seem like what would you predict as the future? Would you say secession or breaking up or civil unrest? What would you say?
Honestly, I hope there's secession and balkanization, because that seems to be the most peaceful option. As peaceful as you can get, I guess, even though that's not particularly peaceful. But I think that there probably is going to continue to be civil unrest and things like that in the future. As far as like an all-out thing, probably not. As long as they can keep people fat and keep people entertained, that's not going to happen. And I don't see that breaking apart anytime soon.
Yeah, it does seem like things are locked into a course. So, okay, with that all said, what would you like to tell people about your artwork and how you got started doing this?
Well, it's funny because I actually got started doing it because my boyfriend requested that I make something. And so I went ahead and did. And I posted it in a private Facebook group back when I was still on that platform. And it got a lot of positive feedback. So I kept making more. And at first they started off as just kind of being memes. And eventually I decided to just go ahead and make an Instagram account. So I did that. And then I guess as I got more into it, it slowly started getting a little bit more artistic. So you can probably see that since, you know, I've got limited time. So I don't make like something every single day. Sometimes there's months in between them just because of how busy I'll get. But you can kind of see the slow progression from it becoming more meme-like to more actually artistic. So, and I really just kind of do it because it's pretty and it goes along with something that I think that we need to do as a culture, which is reconcile the classic with the modern, because there is so much lost from our past and our history and the philosophy of the people at the time and the way that they lived. And there needs to be a reconciliation with that. We can't just completely break away from that as people think that they can. You can never really run from it.
From the Constitution.
Well, not just the Constitution, but from our heritage as Westerners, as Western Europeans. In general.
Right, yes. So would you see that being integrated in a sort of future context? And do you think that, how do you think this is going to play out? I mean, or what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the past is an essential thing? Or, I mean, this genuinely interests me. This sounds like an obvious, the answer's obvious, but I am wondering. I am wondering about this, the extent to which people actually need heritage in this age.
Well, yeah, we always need it. And I think now more than ever, we need positive views of our past and of our heritage. Because, I mean, from the time that we're school children, here in America, at least, all you hear about is, you know, you go instantly from like slavery to the Holocaust. And then that's just like on repeat every single year, you know, white people bad. You did slavery. You did the Holocaust. And that's.
Oh, my God. I can only imagine. I can only imagine what it must be like in high schools in Britain now, because, you know, 20 years ago, it was bad enough. I mean, we were talking about the Holocaust at great length, talking about all the bad things that Britain has done and just none of the good stuff. That was it 20 years ago. God knows what it must be like now.
Oh, no kidding. And I actually had to take a world history course in college about 3 years ago. And I had this particularly anti-white teacher who literally the entire course was just why the English are evil. You know, that was the entire course. The English are evil. Here are all the reasons why, without any mention of any of the good things that the English did or how big of an impact the English had on global culture and on trade and everything else. So, I mean, I'm assuming that's probably the way that they're teaching high schools for the most part now, especially since millennials are teachers now.
Yeah, it's a frightening concept, isn't it?
No, it really is. And, you know, here's the thing. If you're like a non-white person and all the white people that you know are these sniveling, groveling liberals, I almost don't blame you for disliking white people, because you can't respect people who don't respect themselves, you know, and the more people grovel, the more you dislike them. So like, I almost don't blame them to an extent if those are the white people that you know.
Yeah, indeed. I think that that self-hating weakness is a provocation. And it just leads to more self-hate and more weakness and more groveling to the outsider.
Oh, absolutely. Like, no one likes someone who hates themselves. No one respects someone who disrespects themselves. That's just the way it is. So I think the more exposure, especially to, like, I guess the non-white people who do attend college and who are surrounded by the people who fully absorb this, like, yeah, they would absorb it too. And they would, I mean, it's almost like when they see these really, really unimpressive specimens from our people, and these are the ones that they interact with, like, I can see why they think, oh yeah, they were completely undeserving and they must have stolen it. When really what you're doing is comparing a Chihuahua to a wolf.
Yes. Okay. So, heritage, an important thing. Can you talk more about your artwork?
Well, I really like, as anyone who views it can see, I really like classical statues. And I like to take them and I like to put them in more fantastical settings, and I like to bring a lot of color to it and make it a little bit, you know, kind of like the fashion wave aesthetic, but I kind of have my own thing going on. It's not quite just that, but again, it's about reconciling the modern with the classic, which is why you'll see a lot of not just fantastical, but futuristic kind of stuff that goes along with it, with the bright colors, but also a very classical aesthetic to mix with it. Because again, it's about reconciliation. And I do actually think that there's actually a growing movement of dissident intellectuals that have been blogging and stuff like that. One of my favorites is theagonist.org, run by Chris DeGroote. And I think that that blog actually goes along well with my perception and the way I do my art and why I do my art that way.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll try to link to that down below. Okay. I just want to say that the photo that I first saw of yours, the work that I first saw, I believe it's Bath in Britain, the town of Bath, the Roman baths in that city, I think. Oh, I forgot what it's called, but I think it's from there. I'll link people to it just now so that they can see.
Yeah, that's the one. And what's funny is that I didn't know what that was until afterwards. It was just a picture that I found on one of the Creative Commons websites that I go to snag pictures from. You know, like, I have trouble talking about my art and articulating it because it's like, I feel like other people project a lot more meaning onto art than the artists themselves do. Like, honestly, for me, making art is kind of a grug thing. I just kind of do it. I'm just like, oh, this looks nice. Oh, this looks cool. Ooh, I can do this. And a lot of it's just kind of by the seat of my pants. I just decide to do it that way because it looks nice. And then other people will be the ones who put a lot of meaning and symbolism to it. I'm like, yeah, I'm glad you perceive it this way.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. Let's leave it at that. I think this has been a really nice, interesting and concise and fast paced discussion of America and the situation there over the last, 10, 20 years. So are there any final things you'd like to say to people before we close?
No, I think that was it. We had a really great discussion. I was glad to talk to you. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's been great.
Okay. Well, you're very welcome. I've enjoyed this. I think other people have as well. Lots of positive comments in the live chat. So, okay, this was Artemisian Aesthetic, and also on Twitter. I'll link to your Twitter. And thank you very much.
I'll
be back in about 45 minutes with Philosopher Cat. So that'll be the fourth one for tonight, the last one for tonight. So I look forward to that. In the meantime, Artemisian Aesthetic, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2019.
Thank you. Have a Merry Christmas.
And you too. I'll see you all soon.
Sounds good.